I saw in her eyes, the way she looked at me when the Praetorians came down. It was something close to pride. I can't let her die, or Roan, or my Praetorians, or any of the loyal subjects caught between two giants. Too many lives have already been spent too easily by people who should know better. "Did you learn omnicide in the Kuiper?" I asked.
"No, I learned to outsource."
Cryptic. "You mentioned a master maker."
"Ah, yes, your old friend Glirastes. He's no longer just an artificer. He's proven himself a traitor. He abetted the enemy's use of the storm gods. I don't believe it. Trust me when I say men do strange things out of fear. Now he will die with them and his precious city."
He does not sound happy about the last part.
"Now, where are my manners? Are you hungry for a real meal? In the morning we'll be departing for the Anihilo, but I'm sure Atalantia will cause a fuss if I haven't fed you."
He fetches a bowl of fresh bread and two boiled pieces of meat. "What is this?" I ask as I chew.
"What does it taste like?"
"Bat."
"Well, there you have it."
He watches with a strange expression as I eat. It is oddly civilized, this conversation, considering his men only just tortured me. He still has not tendered an apology, nor do I expect he ever will. "You do not seem to advocate for Atalantia's plan," I test.
"I have no tolerance for rebels. But this planet did not rebel, it was conquered. I think you would agree it is a strategic mistake to confuse the two and to cede the moral high ground to the enemy when we've only just reclaimed it. If we kill 20 million, will anyone remember the Reaper Storm?"
"Yet you do not contradict Atalantia." He laughs.
"I am a soldier. Soldiers follow orders."
"She gives you autonomy. Can't you infiltrate the city, bring down their shields from the inside?"
"No. My men inside are dead. The Howlers know counter-espionage all too well, and the Loyalists are as neutered as a Logos."
That puts me in a unique position as I ponder playing yet another stupid game. He grows suspicious. If anything, undermining Atalantia's plan puts him on guard. I want him at ease. Get him talking about himself, about something he likes. I try his mother, Gaia, and tell him of my time with her, but he replies very little and grows somewhat defensive. The figurines, they're the only thing here without utility. I stand and approach them. The detailing is impressive, as is the variety of subject. There are a few golds, but most are low colour. I pick up one of a red woman.
"That one is called Daedra," he explains. "We became familiar on the outskirts of Olympia. Tough woman."
"For a red?"
"Tough woman."
"Are they trophies?" He looks insulted as he joins me.
"They are meditation totems. Each is for a human who preyed upon my prejudices. Daedra seemed harmless, kind, stupid. She brought my men figs and bread every day for a week, until her figs were laced with a nerve agent. 104 men dead, because I could not see her for what she was."
"A zealot?"
"A soldier," he corrects.
I'm still in his peripheral vision. I take a step back and look at the figures with a frown. "Where's Darrow? Surely he's fooled you a few times."
"It's a work in progress. I did the legs before I met him, but how can you understand a man at war with himself?"
He turns his back to me to reach toward the far end of the nook, clenching Daedra in my hand, I ready to swing at the nerve packet located behind his left ear.
"If you strike me, I suggest you have a plan."
He doesn't turn around to defend himself. It throws me off guard.
"I assume you saw my escape map. The tunnels can be tricky, and memory for us mere mortals is fleeting.
He turns around and leans against the wall.
It won't work, you know. Me as your Trojan horse.
It might.
Let's say you did manage to subdue me. Possible, given your youth, but not probable, given your state and my vocation. You would then have to free the Arcosians, use my escape map to that blasted labyrinth, evade my men, flee across the desert, pray Darrow lets you inside Heliopolis, gamble that your thin ruse of Cato or Vitruvius holds, and then kill the most dangerous man alive.
I don't intend on killing him.
And the rest?
Prescient.
Is it for Auctoritas? Glory? To prove you are the heir?
No.
Revenge, then?
No.
Humanitarian concern for your men? Or maybe you fancy the Love Knight, he mocks. Men will do strange things out of fear, but for love, well, death is hardly the limit.
Who are we if we kill a city that did not rebel? I ask.
Interesting. An idealist. Don't fret, it's a temporary condition.
He actually smiles.
They're guarding the wall and the shield generator with an army of veterans, you know. Howlers abound.
Predictable targets.
What is your target, then?
Glorastes.
He is a traitor.
I can turn him back. He goes quiet, thinking. Why are you not calling your men? I ask.
Because I have lived off the contributions of this planet. They have sheltered me and my men. They have fed us. They have informed for us. They have spied and died for us. Not the high colors. They turned their backs like craven, but the low, the mid, those with barely anything to their name, because this is not Mars. This is Mercury. If we just let them burn, what is the point of this?
He thrusts a finger to his scar.
Furthermore, for 2 weeks my men have failed to get me inside Heliopolis. What will you do with Glerastes?
I will know once I see the tools available. But I imagine Darrow knows an attack is coming, and so it likely will be necessary to hoist him on his own petard.
The chances of it working are
minute. He nods to himself.
Obviously my men can't know. Make it look real. Kill them if you must. They know their duty.
He waits for me to hit him.
Well, let's see how good the pupil of Bellona, Octavia and Aja really is.
Is Atlas really going to be a willing participant after what he's done to Darrow's men? You know Darrow will kill you.
Pulvis et umbra sumus. One servant for 20 million citizens is easy math. You have 5 days until the chemical attack, though that may change with my capture.
His conviction makes me doubt myself.
Don't balk now.
He punches me in the nose, breaking it.
Blood spurts out. Do it!
He hits me again, and I charge him. He ducks under me and tries to strip my left leg to take me to the floor in a cravat central pivot. Cassius loved that one. I counter by leaving my feet and rolling over his back, looping one arm under his right armpit as I go, and wrapping my other arm around his neck as I use my central rotation to roll onto my back, with his spine against my stomach. He has a small window to reach his boot knife, but he lets it pass. I loop my arms over his left shoulder and under his right armpit, pinning his right arm up in a salute. I pin his left arm to his side by wrapping both my legs around it and his rib cage and interlocking my ankles. He grunts there, pinned in a brachial choke. His legs kick as I constrict the blood flow to his head, but not even an obsidian could muscle his way out of this. I stare at the doorway as his feet scrabble against the floor. No Gorgons come to check on their leader. There is never any need. When he is unconscious, I release my hold and stand over him, perplexed. I haven't time to understand it. Every moment wasted will make discovery surer. I take the tack net from his weapon's nook and shoot it at his body. It ensnares him. I take his haster from the wall. My Bellona blade lies in the dirt. I almost convince myself that I can bring it with me, but where I'm going I might as well wear my mother's ring. I jump and hide the razor in a cleft in the rock, and use his boot knife to give myself a shallow wound just above the heart. I smear the blood all over my face and neck. The tunnel is dark and empty. Fear's men are still busy with their meal. I move as fast as I can back to the prisoner's room, my bare feet silent on the stone. Two of the Gorgons sit on the floor playing dice when I round the corner. From his place on the wall, Alexander sees me fill the tunnel.
"I want to see the Fear Knight," he cries to the Gorgons.
The guards turn to look at him. I sprint toward them. Aja's lessons guide me. Against a single individual, you can make a non-lethal takedown with relative consistency, but two individuals, even of a lower genus, reduce your chances by 70%. I could kill the two Gorgons with two neat thrusts, but I make it sloppy, as if I've never held a razor. As they turn back at the sound of my feet, I slash half the head off the first man like I'm felling a tree. The blade passes through him as if he weren't even there, and carries on into the second man's throat, one of Cassius's favourite moves against the shoddy armour common in the belt. Then, clumsily, the razor goes into the cave wall. Flopping to the ground, the second man stares up with wide eyes, trying to talk, but I made sure my clumsiness severed his windpipe. I hack at him a second time, a third. Then I give a quiet sob and fall to my knees, covered in blood.
"Gory damn," Alexander breathes.
He kicks the other knights awake.
"Cato, Cato, look at me."
I look up at him, wide-eyed.
"Did anyone see you coming here?"
I shake my head.
"There's keys on their bodies. Unlatch us, and we can help you. Front chest pocket, that's it."
With shaking hands, I free them.
"Cato, have you ever used a razor before?"
Alexander watches the bloody blade in my shaking hands. I pretend not to be able to think. Finally, I shake my head and give him the blade. Practiced hands strip the bodies of their night optics, their sidearms, two grenades, and a single long rifle.
"Tell me what happened. Where is the Fear Knight?"
I show them. The professional soldiers miss nothing. In 30 seconds we have the map, the go-bag, a glow lamp, and the Fear Knight's data pad. For a moment I think they'll discover Cassius's razor too, but Drusilla only takes a wolf pelt from the wall. She hands it to Alexander.
"You've a promise to keep," she tells him.
He holds the pelt for a quiet moment and looks as if he's going to weep. Then he throws it over his shoulders and binds it to his tattered shirt. Ignatius grins as he finds Stims in the Fear Knight's go-bag a moment later. They each shoot a vial into their necks. The zeal of the drug gives their tortured bodies new life, but it won't last long. Correctly deducing that our breakout will soon be noticed, Alexander dispatches Drusilla and Crastus to delay the pursuit.
"How did you get back here?" Ignatius asks. "Why were you in his room?"
"He was being kind to me," I say. "He wanted me to trick you into...
"Doesn't matter, Ignatius," Alexander says. "We have to move."
"We're trapped," I fret. "They're going to impale us."
"No."
He holds up the map.
"This is a back door. We knew we had to have one. We can escape. We are trained for this, Cato. I know you're not, but if you keep up with us, we will keep you alive." "Alexander, we can't afford to be slowed down," Ignatius says. "He's a loyalist anyway. He can't..." "If we get Atlas to the Sovereign, what he has in his head will save millions," Alexander snaps. "This loyalist could have just won the war, and you want to leave him?" "He won't talk. He doesn't need to."
What does he mean by that? Ignatius isn't convinced.
"I don't trust him." "Darrow will question him later," Alexander says.
Ignatius nods.
"You ever seen one of these?" Alexander asks me, holding up a stim vial and looking at my burn. "What is it?" I ask.
"It'll make you fly, good man."
He tilts my neck and injects it.
"How do you feel?"
The military-grade neurotransmitter races through my veins like a galloping destrier, filling me with manic energy and dulling the communication of pain receptors in my brain. For the first time in weeks, my face doesn't feel like it's falling apart. There's a rumbling groan from up the tunnel. Drusilla and Crastus return, stone-faced.
"Armory was too well guarded, so we hit the commissary. They'll be coming soon as they clear the rubble. We have 30 seconds at best."
Alexander smiles.
"Then we have a head start, good men."
He slaps my shoulder and shoves one of the scorchers into my hands.
"On me!"
Chapter 60 Lysander Pup 1 We flee into the labyrinth. Alexander sprints ahead as the stims lend his ravaged body fresh impetus. Buoyed by Mercury's light gravity, Drusilla carries the Fear Knight over her shoulders. The other knights bring up our rear. The detonation of one of our stolen concussion grenades rumbles through the tunnel not far behind. Dust shakes free from the ceiling, clouding the glow lamp Alexander uses to light our way. The tunnel leads us into a convoluted maze cave, where a network of connecting cave passages forms a three-dimensional puzzle. Some asshole terraformer had a gory field day. Alexander guides us well with the map, but I hide my frustration by panting down at the ground when he needs to pause to reference it again and again. Small beeps sound from the walls as the Fear Knight's data pad deactivates booby traps along the way. After half a dozen turns, our tunnel tapers to a keyhole where only two can pass at a time. Drusilla shoves the Fear Knight through to Alexander as one of their compatriots lays a laser trip mine at the keyhole, hoping to collapse it shut. Down a winding slope we go until we reach a fork of three routes lit by green Mycena chlorophos on the ceiling and floor. Bioluminescent juice squishes from the spores as we trod them underfoot to coat our bare feet a ghostly green. Our mines do not detonate. The Gorgons are no amateurs, and they are gaining ground. Right, left, down we go, against all instincts, deeper into the mountain, over a natural bridge that spans an underground river, through a chamber so filled with spores it seems nearly daylight, passing gloomy grottos and opaque pools. Down and down, somewhere through the walls, rushes that underground river. It dwindles, and for several minutes the only sound is the labored breathing of the golds. My fear is as real as theirs. If Atlas's men catch us, they will not talk to me. They will butcher me with Alexander and his kin, and the Fear Knight will apologize to Atalantia as he delivers my mutilated corpse. I feel that fear vibrating like a dark river, but I leech its power and use the adrenaline for my muscles, to narrow my vision, to calibrate my senses, to absorb the slightest change in stimuli. Soon the stench of ammonia fills my nose. I hear a chittering. The air thickens and warms as we enter a microclimate, and the mouth of the tunnel expands to a great cathedral, the floor and walls undercut and eroded by what I presume to be carbonic acid. I grab Alexander to stop him just before he spills over the edge. His men almost bowl us over.
"By Jove," he whispers at the dramatic drop.
He shines his light upward. In the vaulted reaches of the cathedral roost legions of bats. Their ranks cover the ceiling and disappear up into apse flutes, where unseen millions must sleep.
"Milk bats," Alexander whispers.
They paralyze their victims with spines on the inside of their wings. Then they feed on the helpless victim's bone marrow. So Atlas did feed me bat. Damn the black market carvers.
This is why the Board of Quality Control regulated them so assiduously. Men just want to create apex predators because it delights them. But then those predators kill off everything else, overpopulate, and break the ecosystem. I almost laugh at the irony. Beneath the sleeping horde lies a sea of guano. It stretches the entire length of the cavern, its surface writhing with millions of moth roaches and albino centipedes.
"How deep you think it is?" Drusilla whispers.
"Immaterial," Alexander snaps. "It's just shit. Let's go."
"Those aren't milk vats."
"I told you that."
"Their guano can stretch as deep as 30 meters," I say. "And there's wither tails in there." Drusilla tenses, staring at the albino centipedes.
"What's a wither tail?"
"Worse than the bats," I say.
"They're coming,"
Ignatius says with a growl. He squares his big shoulders to the tunnel behind us.
"It must be passable."
Alexander scans the cathedral.
"There."
In the gloom, he spots a narrow shelf of stone leading along right around the guano sea. We rush along it as fast as we dare. Alexander drags the fear knight awkwardly and almost loses him off the edge of the shelf.
6 o'clock, Drusilla shouts.
One of the knights fires at the Gorgon coming out the tunnel. He misses. The Gorgons do not. A projectile hits the knight. His right leg disconnects from his body at the hip joint. He screams as he loses his balance and topples down into the guano. It absorbs him like quicksand. He tries to claw his way to the surface, but, missing a leg, he can't stay atop the sludge. Then he screams as the wither tails find him. Drusilla and the Gorgons exchange fire. High-velocity rounds hiss through the air.
"Crastus!"
Alexander shouts. He's about to jump down to try to rescue his friend. If he dies, this is all for nothing. I grab him and shoot at the ceiling. A million bats explode in a fury. Let their thermal optics deal with that. I drag Alexander, and we make our way along the narrow shelf and out the cathedral, harried by bats the entire way. One's attached itself to Drusilla. Alexander cuts its head off with his razor and peels out its bristles. Drusilla sicks up on the floor but stumbles after us, eyes dazed. Ignatius has to take the fear knight's body. After a series of turns, we find ourselves near the end of the fear knight's map. It is a limestone chamber filled with pools of dark water and stalactites dripping from the ceiling. I stop, searching the bioluminescent lit walls, and feel panic rising in me.
"What is it?" Drusilla asks Alexander. "Are we lost?"
"This isn't on the map," he says.
"What do you mean it isn't on the map?" she asks.
Instead of 2 tunnels, there are 7. Ignatius hurls the fear knight to the ground.
"I knew this was a fool's errand. Looks like it's a fight after all."
Drusilla slumps on a knee, breathing heavily from the milk bat venom.
"We're almost out of ammunition. Which way is it?"
"I don't know," Alexander says.
He pockets the map and slaps the fear knight's face.
"Wake up! Wake up, damn you!"
He doesn't.
"Shit! We make our stand here. Hit them as they come in. Make this a melee affair."
"They have golds too," I say.
"Not like us."
"A lovely sentiment, but untrue," Drusilla says. "There's at least 15 scars. It'll be berserks they send in first."
"Then we die with glory,"
Ignatius mutters. Alexander searches the tunnels. The wrong one will lead us off the map, and we might starve to death before we find a way out. He'd rather fight than trust his chances with that. The Arcosian knights follow Alexander's commands and take up positions around the room to ambush our pursuers, as if you can ambush anyone with thermal optics in a cold cave. If we wanted to fight, it should have been in the guano grotto. Positively criminal how quickly razors reduce genius IQs to simple grunt logic. I face the tunnels. There is no reason the fear knight would have a fake map in his private quarters. Therefore, the map must be real and cannot be wrong. If it is not wrong, then it is shorthand. Two tunnels were supposed to be here, yet there are seven. I search for a pattern of two. Ah, the pools.
I found the way, I whisper. Shut up, or I hear something, Ignatius says.
Alexander hides behind a stalactite, waiting for the gorgons to come from the darkness of the Bat Cathedral.
The pools,
I hiss at the fools. Alexander turns to me.
The pools lead to a tunnel.
I shine the glow lamp down. Sure enough, a tunnel large enough for three men to swim abreast is faintly visible beneath the surface.
You clever bastard.
Alexander slaps me on the back. We dive into the pool. The water is hot and bubbles from cracks in the stone. The glow lamp splashes pale light on the slick tunnels beneath the surface. Alexander covers the Fionite's nose and mouth to stop him from inhaling water. When we emerge in a small grotto, I gasp for air and pull myself onto the slick stone. Alexander and the others breach the water, and I help them lever the Fionite out of the pool. We find the escape grav bikes underneath a camouflage tarp on the far side of the grotto. Concussion and gas traps deactivate from the passive signal in the Fionite's data pad. We take a bike each, slash the fuel cells of the rest with our razors, and tie the Fionite onto the hauling rack of Drusilla's under a portion of the camo tarp. Alexander cuts the camo tarp into several more pieces and secures one on the hauling racks of each bike. Clever thinking. I nod when he asks me if I know how to drive one of the bikes. Not much to do in Erebos, except daylight fancies.
Do not stop for anyone, Alexander tells us.
He inserts the bike's wired comm into his ear and motions me to do the same.
Comm's in. We're playing clamshells, goblin style. Head straight south for Heliopolis. Drusilla will have the Fionite. Everyone else. We're only here to buy her time. They can't use orbit support while we have fear. So don't shy off. Let's get this bastard back to the boss.
He gives them a firm smile, forgetting me completely.
Hail Libertas! Hail Reaper, they echo.
The engines scream like crying babies as we tear off down the tunnel toward daylight. The sunlight blinds, even this late in the afternoon. We take a thin track down the mountain. The grav bike sighs up and down on its gravity cushion, very similar to the bikes Cassius and I used in Darrington Station when running from Syndicate clone traders. The controls are touchy, especially to motor reflexes under the influence of stims, but they're far simpler machines than starshells. A powerful engine provides thrust from behind, as low-powered gravity thrusters beneath create half a meter of floating clearance from the ground. The seat is curved to angle the rider forward with a rear seat for the gunner. Soon I've the hang of it, though I'm by far the worst pilot.
Pop one to Hala one, Alexander announces over the comm, using our transponders to boost his signal in a desperate bid to reach Heliopolis.
It just might. The Society won't be jamming its own frequencies, but if Heliopolis hears it, every gold in 1,000 meters will. I thought this would be a clandestine engagement. He just put it on the big stage.
Pop one to Hala one. Handshake 2345209. We have Anteater. I repeat, we have Anteater. Sliders in pursuit are bearing south at 53.48. 113.41 requesting long malice support. I repeat.
The track spits us out into a salt flat. The knights push the bikes for all they're worth. Alexander's wolf pelt streams behind. They start weaving in and out of one another to confuse enemy targeting. Seems unnecessary. Didn't we destroy the other bikes? I start weaving with them, just a moment before Ignatius banks in front of me, then swerves back without the top half of his muscular body. His grav bike drifts sideways, losing speed. Snipers. I glance back. The cave is barely a dot. We must be 5 kilometers away. An impossible shot, even for lurchers. Something whips past, and a huge crater opens up just left of my bike's nose. I send my bike into frantic contortions, and soon it seems we're out of range,
but Alexander has not let up. He hunches grim-faced over his handlebars, looking left and right, and repeating his message to his master.
Ah, of course.
A swarm of hooded gorgons on grav bikes flow down the nearly vertical face of a sandstone butt to our left. Another swarm pours out of a mountain valley to the right, racing to cut us off before we can get free of the mountains. All over the mountain range, the acolytes of the Fear Knight emerge from subterranean bunkers like hornets from a kicked nest.
Rat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat!
The ground in front of us ruptures with railgun fire, not to kill us, but to drive us west back into the mountains. We call the bluff and drive through it. Debris rips into my burn at 200 kilometers an hour. A rock almost takes my head off. Then we're through, pushing for the open desert. The pursuing bikes still kilometers off. 300 kilometers an hour. The world is a blur, but the mind's eye makes everything feel languorous as I bob and weave around boulders and debris. A vertical silver slash comes down from the sky. Wow! A beam of white light obliterates the horizon, leaving a gash of light across my vision. The sand of the desert pulses deep red as it's turned to glass in a 20-kilometer swath.
Idle banter, Alexander crows. We've got your dog, Grimace. We've got your dog.
I can't help thinking of Cassius and Darrow riding over the Martian highlands of the Institute, crowing nearly the same thing. We careen over the molten desert. The heat radiates upward. My bare feet begin to blister. I pull them up to rest on the chassis. Through the warped air, another squadron of Gorgons appears.
Split 'em! Cato, follow me!
Hadrian banks left with Drusilla. I follow Alexander right. The Gorgons divide to follow us, not knowing which has the Fear Knight. More orbital strikes come down to hem us in, but Alexander is a god on a bike. He leads a whole squadron of Gorgons into a particle beam. They disappear like mist as we bank into a canyon, then spit out the other side. I stick on his tail as we head to the open desert. I glance back. 2 kilometers behind, an army pursues. We'll never make it.
Pump one to Howler one. Do you read me?
No answer but static. Soon society air support will come. They'll be scrambling ripwings. Aerial infantry will block our path. We continue our course. With no way to down us without killing the Fear Knight, it becomes an endurance race. The grav bikes holding steady behind us in the open desert, suggesting a trap up ahead. The giant sun begins to set and stain the horizon the color of hot metal. The stims have faded. The agony of the burn returns, and I see Alexander slumping in his saddle. Drusilla has linked up with us again, though there is no sign of Hadrian. Only 3 bikes remain. Debris from the Battle of Heliopolis begins to litter the sand with shriveled remains of war machines. Soon we can see the storm wall of Heliopolis as a thin metal line in the far distance. But setting down between us and it is a line of mechanized Grimace troopers. They'll have electrical cannons to fry our bikes' electronics. Ripwings buzz overhead suddenly. The society trap closes.
We have to run it,
Alexander says. I see no way through. The pursuing Gorgons creep closer.
Pop one to Howler one,
Alexander calls, panic finally making its way into his voice.
Our path is blocked. Pop one to Howler.
A voice unlike any other comes over the comm.
Howler one to Pop one. Continue course. Long Malice deployed at danger close. Midnight inbound.
Stick tight to me, Alexander says. Cato, Drusilla, stick tight.
Thoom, thoom, thoom. Huge explosions break the face of the desert. They blossom into acrid clouds of smoke and sand in the center of the Grimace troopers. Darrow's artillery guns send another salvo, arching from the city through the air in the thin gap between the storm wall and the dome shield of Heliopolis.
They decimate everything in their path. Huge holes are blown in the pursuing squadrons of grav bikes as artillery shells scream over our heads. It is all absurd sound and fury. Individual patterns in the metal and noise show the intelligent hands at work, move and countermove, measure and countermeasure, and how together they make insanity. All this for the thin man attached to the back of Drusilla's bike. Neither alliance fighting for love or hate, only the utility that one life will provide them. And when I think of that distant look in Atlas's eyes as I choked him out, that look that reminded me of Cassius when he went to face the Ra, I understand what they both knew. How foolish all this rage is. Before I plunge into the smoke of the artillery bombardment, the last thing I see is a rip-wing squadron streaking out from under Heliopolis's shield with guns ablaze. Blinded by dust and smoke, I hug my bike and close my eye. Debris pings off the metal chassis like hailstones and bites at my legs and face. The air is hot and ghastly. I want to sob in terror. I focus my mind's eye, and it all quiets. I weave around the man-sized chunk of starshell, almost in slow motion. Nothing hurts me. Nothing exists but the mind. Then I burst out of the smoke. A wash of clean air as I tear out the other side of the cloud to see a heavy shuttle, unlike any other ever built, hovering a meter above the ground. Alexander drives into it, his bike smashing and sparking as it hits the ramp and careens into the cargo bay. I goose the thruster and nearly fall off my bike as Drusilla's slams into me from the left and locks together with mine, driving me off course. A ragged chunk of metal impales her through the chest. I crank my bike left and skid sideways, dragging hers into the transport. I feel myself sailing through the air. I collide with something unmovable. My shoulder is pulled from its socket. The engines rumble beneath. I feel us rising, and I lie there feeling very calm and present. Because standing over me, roaring for retreat, is the Reaper himself.
Chapter 61. Darrow, Hero of Tyche. The air heaves with shockwaves as the shuttle shoots through the aerial gate in the storm wall and back to the safety of Heliopolis's shield. Remains of bikes litter the shuttle's cargo bay. Drusilla, one of Alexander's cousins, shakes on the floor, a piece of metal through her chest. The medici swarm over her. A second gold groans at my boots. Lean and caked in so much desert chalk, it shudders off him as he coughs. I search him for weapons. His face is mangled and melted on one side. "Get us to the star!" I shout at our pilot. Thraxa jerks a tarpaulin off the back of a crashed bike to reveal a body. She yanks on the man's dark blonde hair so I can see his face. "Look what the pup dragged in!" She spits on his unconscious face and puts all her substantial weight and strength behind her knee to break his sword arm. Then she breaks the right for good measure, before manhandling him into more secure cuffs. "We're going to have some fun, Impaler." I heave a bike out of the way to reveal the last body. Alexander. He's nearly unrecognizable. His ears and several fingers have been cut away, and large strips of skin eaten off. I throw myself over him and check his pulse. It is faint. When I tear open his coat, I find two exit wounds in his chest. "Alexander!" I say, shaking him. "Alexander!" His eyes crack open, and he manages a smile. His teeth are missing, I realize, in horror. His hands pull dumbly at something as he pushes a chalky pelt into my hand.
"Told you I'd bring it back."
Blood bubbles out his mouth and his eyes roll back.
"Faster!"
I shout at the pilot. I cradle Alexander in my arms and jump out the back of the transport before it even makes its emergency landing. The medici are waiting for us, but their gurney will be too slow. I sprint past them, carrying the man, scattering deckhands, not stopping until I lay him down in the medbay. He's barely breathing. Rona rushes into the room behind me, her eyes wild. Alexander! She pushes to his side as the medicar prep him for transport to the surgery ward. Alexander! Her eyes search the horror of his face. His missing ears, the strips of stolen flesh, the toothless mouth as his lips part to murmur something. What did they do to him? She screams. What did they do? Alexander! The medici pull her away and rush with him toward the surgery ward. I follow. A chief medicus pushes at me, her feet sliding on the floor. Sir, we're going with him, I snarl. Then you're going to contaminate the room and terrify my surgeons, the medicus says. Wait here. Do not let that boy die, I say to her. Do you understand me? We'll do what is medically possible, sir. Rona and I are left in the silence of the intake room, listening to machines beep. A ragged breath escapes her, and her skeleton seems to fold in on itself as she hunches in a corner. She was furious when I left her behind to get Alexander, but she's still in no shape for combat. I thought deep down that this had to be some trick, some trap of the Fear Knights. It seemed impossible to hope, yet I took the risk. And now that Alexander is alive, somehow, despite everything, he may yet be taken. It all seems so unfair. Fear butchered him, Rona says, too numb to cry. He cut him to pieces. Do you have coagulant? I ask a medical officer. The officer disappears through a door and comes back with an injector. I'll be right back, I tell Rona. Don't, she says as I reach the door. Just don't. I make no promises as I leave.
I stalk through the brig. Saud and Carthii prisoners idle about in their cells to either side. Soldiers mill outside an open high-security cell. They press to the walls, clearing the way when they see me charging with a full head of steam. Darrow! Fraxa warns, blocking the door into the cell and holding up her hands. Move!
I know how you feel. If it were up to me, I'd beat him to death with a tea kettle. But we need information from him. I take a step close enough to her that I can see the clogged pores of her broad nose.
Move!
She moves. Inside the cell, the Fear Knight is being woken up by a medicus and scanned by a team of techs. Get out, I tell the medicus, but don't go far. He'll need you soon. The Fear Knight sits up on the foam mattress and looks at me with a start as the vebrine they've given him kicks in. I inject his neck with a coagulant and take the cuffs off his hands. His arms bend unnaturally from Thraxa's rough handling. I survey the monster. The rim gold is skinny from his time in the desert, like a piece of dehydrated beef. Pensive, intelligent eyes stare back at me from under the chalk without even a trace of fear. It isn't like the jackal, whose eyes were like empty bowls. Neither are they animalistic like Atalantia's. These are soulful eyes of a man who knows he's chewing on human flesh and swallows because he can. I lean forward. If I came to you laid out like a suckling pig, would you accept the boon without suspicion? Highly doubtful. I look at his hands. How many of my men have those hands impaled? Enough, so it seems. Did those hands cut my howler's ears off? They did. I pull my razor off my arm and let it hang loose. Do you think you deserve to keep them? My sling blade forms slowly at my side. He turns his hands over, as if viewing them for the first time, and speaks to me in Latin, before translating to common. Caesar was a clod, but he got one thing right. War gives the right to the conquerors to impose any condition they please upon the vanquished. He presents his hands to me. I prepare to cut them off. Yet my hand stays still at my side. A week ago, I would have. Throughout the war, I've done worse. But it would not be for my army. It would be for me. Was this the compromise that poisoned our republic? Was this rage what made us forget that our hope is founded in our virtue? Virtue that has been sorely lacking, and which led to Orion's genocide. All of a man's affairs become diseased when he wishes to cure evils by evils, Atlas recites. For order, I impaled soldiers. For liberty, you drowned cities. The victor writes history with the blood of the vanquished. I wonder, in the end, which of us will turn out the hero? Don't you? I leave the Fear Knight without a word. Outside, I find Thraxa waiting for me with several dozen of Rat Legion. Get information from him, I order. I'll lead the torture personally, Thraxa says. I look back at the man. I know better than most how any man will have to cave to torture in the end. But I also fear false information. He'll just lead us astray. My wife will crack him. Thraxa looks concerned. Darrow, Virginia is, and so was Alexander until today. I survey the legionnaires with Thraxa and make it a moral victory. Use all means within the bounds of the new compact. If the Vox won't obey it, we will. The information he has in his head could win this war. The men will want to cut that head off. If he dies, I will hold Rat Legion accountable. They salute. What about Cato? Thraxa asks.
Who?
The Fourth Gold. He says he helped them escape. No confirmation yet from Alexander. I look back at the Fear Knight. He's a man of too many layers. Was this planned to get him inside? Cato inside. Would Atlas risk that? I don't need another variable here. If Alexander survives, we'll ask him ourselves about this Cato. Until then, isolate him, check his story, and order a full analysis. A vigil waits outside the medical bay. Alexander's cult of young gold acolytes has swollen to include men and women from all branches. Colloway exits as I reach the door. I frown, wondering if I have the wrong room. He holds little love for Alex, but now he just shrugs at my expression and claps my shoulder. Chin up. Your boy's a Stoneside, ain't he? I join Rona and sit in the chair beside her. She looks at my razor for traces of blood. I shake my head. With a nod for herself, she puts her small hand over mine, and together we wait. We're woken sometime in the night by the medicus. The cold woman has not even the faint trace of a smile as she tells us that Alexander survived, and we can see him in the morning. When the medicus returns, I let Rona go in first. After several minutes, she reappears with red-rimmed eyes. She smiles. He's asking for the boss. Alexander lies shirtless in the bed, perforated with IVs. His face is still swollen, and bandages cover the empty ear sockets. He reaches a hand out to clasp Rona's as I loom over him. "Lo, boss," he says, with a childish smile. "Hey, kid, thanks for bringing back my cloak." Glerastes is snorting drugs as Harnassus paces a hole in the briefing room carpet. A silver Chimera drug dispenser full of sawdust slips out from the master maker's voluminous sleeve. I pull up a chair and sit across from him. He admires his Chimera. "When I had my first bite of sawdust, I thought I had arrived. I was a young man, of course, and once you've had stallions galloping through your veins, well..." He dabs the golden powder that rims his nostril and looks at it. "Very nearly cost my career.
It was a long time before I realized one doesn't have to drink the whole glass in one gulp. Pulling back his upper eyelid, he works the powder into his eye and sighs. I'm told you've stopped working, I say. Sardines again. God, no. It's a Thursday, Glorasti says. I'm sure you would agree certain standards must be maintained in a professional relationship between patron and artist. For instance, I would never deem it appropriate to imprison any of your friends and accept felicitations from you. It would simply compromise the relationship. Arnassus says you're close with this Cato Aur Vitruvius. You sound tired, Dara. It's been a long week. Then don't make it longer on yourself. Cato is, in many ways, my only pupil. That callow boy did what all your men could not. I know. When I first met him, I was as dubious as you are now, just another fawning sycophant relying upon the wealth of his parents for access to me. Disgusting. But he has depth to him. He appreciates the grand without sacrificing the minute. You drowned half of Helios. I mourned for the dead. And now that one of them, a boy who is like a son to me, has come back, you think you can keep him from me? Glorasti shakes his head. I have done all you asked. I am your gateway out of hell. He leans back and rests his hands on his tummy. It is your army, so do what you will. But if Cato is not out of your prison and sharing a toast to life with me over a glass of Shiraz by tonight, then you will have to find yourself another master maker to build your gateway. Through the video feed, I watch Cato Aur Vitruvius admit that he is a libertine to our lie detector. Science? I ask my yellow science officer. Arnassus has assembled a team I put on Cato to deliver their full analysis. We ran his DNA against the Active Society Military Database and Gorgon NOC list with no matches. He is not a member, nor does he have relations in their military. Of course, without connection to Skyhall, we don't have access to the census records. Screwface nods from his darkened corner. He brought us the military database information. Ain't laid eyes on that sorry pixie before. If he's a Gorgon, he's young, deep, and out on a limb. Linguistics? His dialect is rare, Pink says. It has inflections of Western Ladanese, which is the predominant accent of Erebos and its surrounding municipalities. But it is primarily Heliopolitan Oriate. So he's lying about his origins? No, the slender Pink says. On the contrary, patrician families of Erebus consider Western Ladanese to be a plebeian tongue. Most embrace the Tychian accent, but a minority of ancient families consider that to be inelegant, and so train their children against the grain in the affectation of old Heliopolitan. It's a nuance so particular, the notion that he would think to imitate it beggars belief.
Why? I ask.
I can speak common in 98 dialects, and even I have not thought it practical to master old Heliopolitan. No one speaks it except maybe 200 families of Erebos.
Medical.
A yellow pipes up from behind his optical display.
He has no signs of military-grade implantation, no foreign elements in his person, nor radiation marking except minor radiation poisoning. His blood pressure is low, heart is abnormally powerful, 25 beats per minute, and shows significant signs of Mithridatism, a practice common in secondary Aureate families as emulation of the more significant families.
Maniacs, Arnassus mutters. Poisoning yourself is now fashion.
Been hot on the Palatine and Venus for years,
Screwface says. I slipped Atalantia a full dose of Methracine, and all she got was a brief bout of bloody emesis. The yellow plods on.
While we cannot divine if he has razor pattern calluses owing to the burns on his hands, he has never borne a peerless scar. There is no sign of facial skin grafting or bone reconstruction to cover an existent one. His wounds are consistent with his story. His brain scans do not show signs of securitas conditioning. However, his limbic system has some unusual synaptic activity, which may be signs of childhood trauma and memory repression, but would require additional analysis to render conclusive. Overall, he is an extremely healthy adult aureate between 18 and 23 years old.
So what you are all saying is that he is telling the truth. Or lying very well, I say. Let's find out which. Screw, I want your eyes on this.
Chapter 62. Lysander. The Warlord and the Libertine. Alteration in vocal patterns, unnatural stillness, timing lag between verbal statements and physical expression, distancing language, linear left eye drift, abnormal gesticulation, extraneous over-explanation, pupil dilation, swallowing, grooming gestures, head canting, pulse rapidity, irregular blinking. These are some of the most obvious symptoms of lying that are drilled into Securitas agents in order to drill them out. To become a full-fledged Venator or Frumentarius, one must have a 90% success rate in telling a lie to an instructor. Of course, I passed Grandmother's exam when I was 6. So it is with droll amusement that I stare down the optic reader of their robotic lie detector and think nothing much of it. It is profoundly large, almost the size of a small man, chrome, spherical, floating, with a hulking red eye. It is grandiosely named Bloodhound XTC-1400, a product of Sun Industries, which no doubt cost Skyhall billions in research and development money to old Regulus. I can understand the investment. In a war where each side wields hundreds of thousands of informants and covert agents, it is as good as a guillotine. But for all this new civilization's love affair with technology, they've been seduced by their own cleverness and fail to understand the simple truth. Lying is not a science. It is an art. And art will always be a human language. I was under observation when we rose over the city wall under heavy fire, when Darrow jumped out with Alexander bleeding everywhere. When they took me on a stretcher to their med bay, when they treated my burns and wounds, when they asked me questions while I was drugged with narcotics, when I showered, when I ate steak, potatoes, and greens, laced with some mild inhibition inhibitor in my safe room, when armed guards escorted me to be interviewed casually, when I gave a formal interview to 2 ethereal pinks, when a handsome gold howler interrogated me, when I used the restroom, and when I walked through the hall to sit in this white room for 2 hours as their little toy investigated my story. They are not measuring lies now. They are cross-referencing current patterns with normal patterns from their recordings by asking a mix of old and new questions. It is a fruitless endeavor. How did you come to be captured by the Gorgons? I stepped on a landmine while trying to put your men out of their misery. You killed them? One, have you ever seen a man impaled? You did not try to save their lives? Have you ever seen a man impaled? How did you kill them? With a scorcher. What type? I don't know. Where did you get it? It was my father's. And you do not know the type? It was a pistol. What are the names of your parents? The machine asks, in the 15th line of inquiry about my parents. It is the first time it has asked for their names. Actus O'Sullivan and Letitia O'Vitruvius. Real people, real family. Paid off upon the 3 visits I made to Mercury to substantiate my identity. Thank Jove, Grandmother was paranoid of assassination. I would be concerned if I didn't know that years ago, when my grandmother died, my godfather activated a protocol which erased the census records of all Golds, fearing the Rising would use the list as an assassination tool. Their sole verifier for my tale is a man wildly popular with the low colours of Mercury and invaluable to their cause, who is no doubt being questioned in another room, in a much less menacing fashion, as to whether he knows Cato or Vitruvius. Glerastes will be shocked to hear the name, but when he does, he will know I am alive, and that man has never wished harm upon me. Even if they press him, a partial truth is hard to detect as a lie, because it comes from memory instead of the creative centre of the brain, an entirely different physiological reaction. In any case, artists are fantastic liars.
When did you first meet Glerastes?
In Tyche, at his offices.
Did you seek the meeting?
Yes.
How old were you?
6, 7.
Why did you seek the meeting?
He built the water gardens, the library of Erebos, the water colossus, the ocular sphere. He's a god here, as oranges go.
Why were you in Tyche?
My parents were doing something, I don't remember what. They liked parties, I know that.
Why Vitruvius?
The machine asks, instead of the perfectly functional green and pink humans sitting behind it.
These people, first the mines, now interrogations,
they're literally roboticizing themselves to death. My mother was...
Well, it's embarrassing.
The machine doesn't care, it just watches. She made a bit of a cuckold out of my father from the start, metaphorically. Then literally. Her family was older, so
how did you overpower the fear knight?
Overpower? I didn't.
Rephrasing, how did you come to render him unconscious?
I hit him on the head with a figurine, and then I choked him. He makes figurines. He is an absurd man.
Why was he showing you figurines?
I don't know.
Did you view his interest in you to be sexual in nature?
Sexual?
Did he attempt to have intercourse with you?
You've seen my face. I look like ground hummingbird tongue. Would you fornicate with me?
I ask for questions here,
the machine replies. The door slams open, and over 2 meters of terror walks in, as if it intends to stomp the room in half. The techs behind the machine scramble to salute as Darrow pushes the machine to the side.
Can it work in the corner? He asks.
Yes, Imperator.
Then why is it jammed up to his face?
It's on intimidation setting, sir.
Bloody damn toaster.
Darrow pushes the billion credit machine into the corner like he's setting a rotund child in timeout.
Stay,
he says to it, pointing a finger. He looks around for a chair. One appears at the door, carried by a tiny red girl, with Drachenjäger bolts. They're using children in their armies now. Did she help kill my men?
Uncle,
she gestures to the chair. Interesting. Kieran's eldest, then, Rona. A lancer now, like Alexander. She looks excited. She smiles at me. I return it in blithe fashion.
Thank you.
Darrow sighs down into the chair as if he had the weight of 20 million people on his shoulders, which may be an understatement.
Get out of here, Rona. I know you're dying to see the hero.
She blushes. I am not.
Lying,
the machine bleats from the corner. Darrow smirks.
Get.
The red child scampers to the door, turns in a very military-like fashion and salutes. Not Darrow, but me.
Alexander senses gratitude. Be nice to him, Uncle. He looks about to piss himself.
She shuts the door, and the killer of Octavia, Aja, and my godfather turns his eyes on me. He wields them like sledgehammers. Yet there is some relatable quality there in those carved organics, some weariness that lacks pretension and would make you think he's an everyman, instead of a warlord who has started a crusade that has claimed 250 million lives and counting.
Long day, he says.
It would seem. I look down to signify submission, then up to signal bravery, then down, as Cato realizes he can't match a legend's gaze. Darrow is used to this, and I make sure my hands play their proper role, knowing very well how the jackal lost his hand. That was always my favourite scene from the recordings, but unlike the jackal, I won't taunt him or try to appear anything other than what he wants me to be, and I dare not risk sticking my head in a meat grinder by attempting to extract information from Darrow. "May I just say, it is an honour to meet you," I say.
"Is it?"
"I've watched all your hollows. My favourite is still when you took the vanguard."
"The packs," he corrects.
"Of course. Not necessarily a fan of all your work, but you have style." He grimaces.
"Those hollows are illegal on Mercury. So are storm gods, my good man.
Sorry. Too soon?"
"Millions died in that hypercane, and you jest."
"To be fair, you did it. But what is the North Coast to me? Tyche, the children, it's all for new money arrogance."
He looks about to say something, but bites it back. "You don't strike me as our usual recruit."
"Recruit? No, God's me, a soldier. Don't be ridiculous, my good man. I'm not nearly Martian enough for all that terror."
"No.
He already wants to be rid of me, 1,000 things on his mind. Good, I'll fit into his gestalt."
"You brought something dear back to me, Cato. In a way, you gave my army hope again. Alexander saved 83,426 souls in Tyche."
"Did he? He never mentioned it."
"No." Darrow smiles at that, almost as a father would. "Throw in the sadist knight, and it's the best bloody damn present I've been given since my wife gave me this beauty."
He sets his hand on the famous white blade. It is inert and coiled around his arm like a snake. "So you can understand if I'm a little suspicious how a self-confessed libertine from, was it Erebos, brought me all these presents, when 10 million professional soldiers and my howlers could not."
"Maybe you should ask them that question," I say.
He laughs. "You're funny. But not very likable, are you? I can see why your Glerastes is type.
May I ask what you plan to do for me?"
"For you?"
"Yes. I assume I'm entitled to some sort of reward. I mean, you did say I did what 10 million men could not."
I give my most self-satisfied smile.
"You want a reward?"
"Have you looked outside, man?"
"No, I don't have windows in my cell. I think he wants to punch my head off my neck."
"Gods, I hate you people," he says. His patience is thinner than usual.
"If it were up to me, I would lock you away, humanely, until this is all over. I am short on time, and the last thing I need is another spice in the pot. But, as it is, you happen to be friends with a very temperamental master maker whose services I require, and he has argued for your release due to your actions. Let's set that straight. I have no intention of releasing you. The streets of Heliopolis are no place for
gold libertines?
More like gold corpses." He lets that sit. "My men lost a good deal of friends, and the impalement has made them reflexive. But I also don't want you here in my headquarters. Friend of Glerastes or not, I don't know you, and I've taken enough risks. So I will give you to him on several conditions. You do not leave the grounds of his estate, and you submit to inspections whenever my guards at his villa ask you to."
"That's acceptable to me. He has a fine villa. Have you ever walked through the orchard there? He has the most lovely orchard gazebo at the centre."
He stares at me. "Right. Well, take care, Cato or Vitruvian."
"Vitruvius." "No reward, then?" I ask as he reaches the door. He sighs.
"What do you want?"
"Several pinks would do right prime. Come now, my good man, surely you don't abstain completely. What man could?"
"Say that again."
He takes a step back toward me. I look at the ground. "That's what I thought."
Accompanied by Republic legionnaires and a fleet of aides, Glerastes waits for me beside a large fountain of Laocoon and his sons in the foyer of the mound. I can scarcely believe it is him. The bald master maker has always been slender, but now his aspect borders on cadaverous. Amongst the slurry of modern uniforms, his crimson linen robe with silver brocade makes him seem an out-of-place actor from a vulgar Plautusian play. When he sees me, those narrow orange eyes ignite.
"Cato, O Vitruvius, my lad, my heart," he cries,
and I am swallowed in crimson linen. I feel like I'm hugging a skeleton. He pulls back to look up at me. The last time we met, he was a half meter taller than me. Now it is the reverse.
"Your face!"
"A mere souvenir of a ghastly affair," I reply. "Perish the memories."
"Yes, let them perish indeed. You have quite the adventure to share. Let us away."
Chapter 63. Darrow. Unremarkable. Thraxa watches Cato and Gliorastes board the flyer. "You saw how he knocked Drusilla's bike into the hold," she says. "That's some damn flying from a pixie." She turns back to me. "If you gave me 2 minutes with Gliorastes, he'd have been begging to get back to work."
"You didn't see the man," Harnassus says. "It's like his prodigal son has returned. He was catatonic at the idea Cato might be a spy. Thinks we'll torture him or put him in a hole. If we didn't give him to the old Cretan, who'd finish the project?"
"You," Thraxa says.
"I wish I could," he replies.
I watch Cato as the door shuts.
"What do you think?" I ask Screw.
"Nothing remarkable there, just a pixie twit."
"Still..."
"Agreed."
"One thing troubles me. Alexander took me through their escape. If Cato is so unremarkable, how is it that he survived, and soldiers like Crestus and Drusilla did not? Luck only goes so far."
Screw put a monitor spike in him when loading him with anti-rads.
I tell Thraxa and Harnassus, "You're both right. We need our master maker. But more important, we need to know if he is our master maker. We'll watch and listen. Whether he's Atalantia's spy or just a provincial asshole, if Gliorastes has gone sour, we'll find out through that pixie right there."
Chapter 64. Lysander. To master a maker. Lady Beatrice, the home of Gliorastes, is a wonder. Perched several hundred metres up the face of a mountain cliff overlooking the sea, the marble and glass monument to the bizarre would often be seen floating over the Bay of Sirens during the gentle spring months alongside the pleasure craft of the rich and famous. Now, with fuel monopolised by the rising military, its womanly shape rests on its landing foundations. It is colder than I remember. The little details have been forgotten. Flowers rot in vases, scum floats in shallow fountains, rooms are dusty and unlit, apples rot on the orchard grass. Much of Glorastes' staff, I learn, have been pressed or have volunteered for service with the rising. Many more were lost in his offices in Tyche or excused for security concerns. Glorastes himself mirrors the house. He is guarded and faded. He would not speak to me in the shuttle except to extend the ruse. I took his lead, understanding that they likely fixed me with a monitor spike.
"You remember Exeter, of course," he says to me as we are greeted at the landing pad by his valet.
Exeter is a spindly, bone-pale man with a cadaverous face as emotive as concrete. Few know he is the administrative genius behind Glorastes' architectural empire. In the 3 springs I spent with Glorastes, I've only seen the eerie brown smile once. It was early spring, and the apple blossoms were in bloom, and a mother bluebell was building a nest. "Of course. Always a pleasure. Are you still collecting those queer insects?" I ask.
"I fear I haven't the time for passions these last years, Dominus,"
Exeter says. However, my collection has grown since...
He doesn't want to hear about your eerie collection, Exeter. It is immensely creepy,
Glerastes says. Republic guards loiter in the foyer.
Exeter will see you to your room, Cato.
I rather hope to have a discussion with you. I have work to do. I will see you at supper, if I have time. It is important, I said, if I have time. Knowing the spike will record all conversation via vocal vibrations and cameras will record all the rest, I play the part of a libertine and treat myself to a long bath in the guest suite. Inside, my clock is ticking. 4 days before the strike. 4 days, and I sit in a bath of lavender oil. It takes me back to the horror of the impalement, and I puzzle over the enigma that is the Fear Knight. He is likely being tortured at this very moment. Why would he trust me with his life on so thin a plan? Could he possibly care so much for the people of Heliopolis? Do true servants of the society exist now only in the most deplorable form? After the bath, I stare at my face in the bathroom mirror. I do not recognize myself. The desert has weathered my visage and stripped away much of its youth. My right cheek is sunken and peeling from sunburn. Carefully, I take the res flesh off my left cheek. The burn is livid. Drained of fluid, it gives the appearance of melted pink wax. It is not as grotesque as it must have been in the desert, but chunks of metal are still embedded too deeply in the drooping skin to be removed by anyone but an expensive surgeon or carver. The eye has gone smoky white. I am not repulsed. I always thought golds who kept their scars to be a bit vain, but I understand it now. Too much has always been made of my looks, as if I earned them by virtue of being born. This I earned. This is mine. That night, Glerastes's rose quartz table is set for one. I eat in silence, catered to by 3 servants. If they remember me, they do not show it. My old friend never comes. The next morning I learn he has not returned from his labor in the city. I spend my time in leisure, walking the orchard, swimming in his pool, conversing with the rising guards, as much as they will talk to a gold. Most want to kill me on sight. But I learn their patterns, and I yearn to investigate Glerastes's domed workshop, but I dare not. After lunch, I walk the house, bouncing a rubber ball as I go, careful to remain frivolous. I let it bounce awkwardly off a step and chase the ball down a hallway into his library. There I thumb through his dusty books and play games on a hologrid, and when I tire of them I make my way up the spiral staircase of the tower, poking around until I stumble upon his old golden telescope that looks down at the city. With a yawn I look through and make my first surveillance. Stretching north nearly as far as the eye can see, sprawls an architect's delight of basilicas, temples, forums, triumphal arches, historical columns, amphitheatres, and the great hippodrome. Only the distant storm wall does not shine white in the sun. In the western city, Corinthian-inspired office spires, broken only by parks, viaducts, and amphitheatres, stretch all the way to the Bay of Sirens. The mountains cup the fabled city in their loving palms. Their craggy summits are tipped white with snow and festooned with gun batteries. Their ranges stretch hundreds of kilometers, impassable by any land army. To take the city by conventional means, Atalantia would lose millions of men she needs for her campaign. Her chemical option is not so insensible strategically, considering her losses in the battle on the Ladan. But it is short-sighted and immoral. When last I was here, the air above Heliopolis was clear but for the sparkling of an occasional yacht or policing unit. Now it is mobbed by an ugly flood of heterogeneous military vessels, haulers, and civilian rickshaws. The boulevards beneath teem with even more traffic and pedestrians. The city is near bursting with wounded and refugees. Military camps and field hospitals cover the parks and fill amphitheatres where low and high alike once gathered with chilled wine
to watch Sophocles' tragedies free of charge. Troops jog through the Via Triumphia, where victorious charioteers would parade their steeds to the wild acclaim of the crowds. To the southwest, on the outer limits of the sprawling city, I see Heliopolis's spaceport. Beyond the smaller torch ships and destroyers, dwarfing even the mountains, lies a mound of metal. The Morning Star. Thousands of engineers work to repair her hull. Flights of haulers ferry fresh armaments from the southern missile factories to the spaceport. They unload the missile boxes on skiffs suspended on gravity cushions to funnel into the ship's port side. Heliopolis is much as one would imagine it to be, preparing for a siege. However, Darrow knows he would never survive one. So I pay close attention to the spaceport. There is an aberration in the pattern that sticks out like a loose thread. I look back at the skiffs unloading the missiles, use the telescope's relative positional measuring system on all 40 of the unloading skiffs, yawn, and abandon the telescope tower for a book of poetry. My mind whirs as I stare at the words on the page. Those skiff models have a default 0.7-meter gravity cushion from the ground. More than half were up 0.4 meters, according to the telescope. I calculate the volume of the missile boxes and the mass that the Pelham missiles should make. It does not account for the 0.3-meter sag. Not even close. Something else is in them, something at least 5 times as heavy. But what? Full to the brim, it would take something with a density of at least 20 grams.